welcome to episode 4 of Caged In Presents Movie Brat Bros to Palmarama, the podcast where we are going through every single film of the maestro of mayhem, the Hitchcockian connoisseur himself, Brian De Palma. This week I have the absolute pleasure of talking to not one but two guests in the form of Mark Searby, who has written a fantastic book called Al Pacino, The Movies Behind the Man. And I'm also joined by Matt Brothers, who, if you listen to the regular podcast, may recognise from an episode we did on Ed Wood, a now famous episode, especially amongst certain circles, in regards to the fact that it was, for a while, a lost episode, because I lost my audio for that episode, and me and Matt had to re-record that at a later date. Maybe one day that lost episode will return in some way. Who knows? But, yeah, we are talking about Brian De Palma's 1993 movie, Carlito's Way. But you already know that because it's in the title of the podcast. And if your ears are pricked up, you may hear the opening score below me talking right now. This was a really fun chat, and it was kind of... the recording process itself almost mirrored the film in that I totally forgot that Zoom only gives you 40 minutes now if you have more than one guest on. And it's been a while since I've had a Zoom with more than one other person for the podcast. So it's very much an aspect of us racing against the clock like Carlito at the end of this movie. But either way, it was a lot of fun, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. So I guess all that's left to do is to get movie bratting with the bros.
Court of Appeals decision. Now devolve upon me the painful duty of unleashing upon society a reputed assassin. The prisoner's discharge. Call the next case.
You Carlito Brigante, man. You a legend.
He's one of us.
Puts money in everybody's pocket, big time.
He was big.
He's a tough guy.
He just got out of Lewisburg, man.
Charlie.
Now I am sitting in jail, wondering where you are, what you're doing, who you're with.
What was it like inside, Charlie?
They get you.
Carlito, these new kids nowadays, they're shocked on you. Just see you fly up in the air, man.
Who are you working with?
Retired.
That's right. Retired.
I got a good feeling about this club. I think we're gonna make some real money.
But as soon as I make my 75, I'm split.
Maybe you don't remember me. My name is...
Maybe I don't remember the last time I blew my nose. If I ever see you here again, you die.
Did you ever kill anybody, Charlie?
Guys went down. Yeah, you just do what you gotta do to survive.
I give you $1 million to make a simple pay with, and nothing happens.
The contract's already down in your palm. You're gonna end up in that river out there.
I'm asking for your help.
Yeah, well, I ain't dealing. I ain't going back to prison no matter what.
You said you would pay my child.
I gotta do this, just this one thing, and then I'm out.
Every instinct you've got won't do anything but get you killed.
He saved my life, Gail.
Whatever he wants you to do, don't do it.
That's what I am, right or wrong. I can't change that.
Never give up your friends, Dave.
And there's only one rule, you save your own ass.
Didn't you ever have a dream?
Yeah, I had a dream, Charlie. But now I'm awake.
I'm reloaded and back with another conversation about a film of Brian De Palma. This week we're talking his 1993 crime thriller Carlito's Way. Joining me to hopefully get me on the straight and narrow away from my old life of crime is my two attorneys. First up, is journalist and most prescient for this conversation, it must be said, is the author of Al Pacino, the movies behind the man, Mark Searby. And my other counsel on the bench for this chat is the busiest man in podcasting. You know him from Is Paul Dano OK?, Sudden Double Deep and Spotlight. It's, of course, friend of the podcast, Matt Brothers. How are you, gentlemen?
Thanks. Good. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. I was going to do a hoo-ha, and then I realised that's the wrong film.
It's got a court scene, right? So I
think yes, that's true. Yes.
Doing very well, guys. Yeah, I'm loving Mark's background here, proving the Pacino expert. I can see not only a Serpico poster, but a cutout as well.
the cutout was from the book launch.
Amazing. So
a few years ago, Al Pacino, in inverted commas, turned up in cardboard cutout form, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to keep that. The only problem is that where he's situated in this room, he stares out into the hallway. So if you get up late at night and you're not really looking, the moon is shining at a certain point. Al Pacino is looking at you at 3 a.m, which is kind of off-putting. Or maybe not. Maybe some people like that. I don't know.
Got a great ass.
Yeah, give me some compliments as you're
thank you, Al.
Thanks, Al. Well, before we get too deep down, we'll be talking loads about Al Pacino. But before we do that, I just want to know, what were your introductions to Brian De Palma? And we'll kick off with you, Matt. What was your entry point to De Palma?
Christ, I'm not really sure, you know, but it might be this film. Because as a lot of my chats on other pods go, it seems a lot of my movie history goes back to my old friend Paul, from co-host of Spotlight, who with his extensive DVD library back in the raging early noughties, when that was the only way to source a whole lot of these things, put me onto so much stuff. And I'm definitely sure including this would have been when I first saw it. I think I was maybe aware of both, say, Carrie and Scarface, like some of the big ones. And then
what about Mission Impossible?
Only some of his deeper... Mission Impossible, of course, yeah. And I mean, at the time, I was probably all about Mission Impossible 2, let's be honest, when I was about 14, but definitely caught up with it. And then, yeah, I think a lot of his deeper cuts I've slowly started to catch up on now, and there's still a lot unseen of mine, of his, that I need to catch up on as well.
What about...
But, yeah, that would have been it.
What about yourself, Mark? Where did you first become aware of Brian De Palma?
Scarface, plain and simple. You know, that's... Obviously, being a huge Al Pacino fan, that's one of the, you know, one of the top films, isn't it, that everybody tells you to watch? And I think that's where it came from. And then certainly Carlito's Way After, I think that's where I realized that there's a different guy here. Even though it's the same director, it's a different guy. It's not the same movie. I know we'll talk about this in a bit, but he's looking at something completely different here. And maybe this is a bit more nuanced than Scarface is.
Yeah, well, I think when it came to like approaching this project, Brian De Palma was massively reticent because of the fact he's like, I've done an Al Pacino movie like about a gangster. He started like reading the Spanish dialogue and he's like, oh no, it's Scarface again. And I imagine that project is probably, when I get to that film, it's littered with how do we call it, a big Oliver Stone kind of kind of barrier in the way of trying to get that film made. So imagine, yeah, that kind of feeling of having that on you. You probably didn't want to go back to this world in a way, but like I think once he read the script was like, oh no, this is something completely different. Like it's I think he saw it as a noir, which I guess you can kind of see in the visuals of it, definitely. But yeah, before we talk about it, like get really down deep into this film, I just wanted to know from you guys, and we'll start with you, Mark, what do you see as like the tropes of a De Palma film? Obviously, kind of, he's a very visual director. What are the things you think of when you think of a De Palma movie?
It's a really good question. Really good question. And I'm sure there are more intelligent people than me who will be able to answer that straight off the bat. Maybe you guys can, you know, and if you do, you're more intelligent than me. That's great. I don't know. I mean, excess... Certainly, you know, you think about Scarface, that's full of excess. Think about some of his sexier works as well. I think an attitude, you know, there's an attitude of well, fuck it, I'm going to do it. That's it. You know, I don't give a shit. Bold filmmaking, yes, as well, maybe. A guy who genuinely knows filmmaking, knows what he wants from the off. And if you're not into it, then you're going to be left behind, which, you know, has happened in a lot of his films. There's been some performances where you're like, this does not fit here at all. And I don't think they buy into the De Palma vision. So what are his tropes? Yeah, I think aggression is maybe one of them. Some people will tell me no, but I think that, having seen quite a lot of his stuff, I would go with that, from my point anyway.
I think what is quite great is there was a like journalist back in the day who Martin Amis dubbed him Martin De Plasma for the amount of blood that he kind of had in his movies, which I thought was like a kind of, you talk about that excess, and I think like excessive violence is something that he sometimes revels in. What about yourself, Matt? What would you say the tropes are of a De Palma film?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, he's definitely someone with his own style and approach. And like we've said, I think he's very much someone who knows how to put together a film, especially in his heyday. And it's interesting that he's very much has this kind of auteur-ness to him, but he's also, you could look at his filmography and say he's a bit of a journeyman as well. You know, he jumps from like musicals and horrors to kind of thrillers and hard-boiled noirs and gangster films. both kind of period and contemporary, and then, you know, spy movies as well. Like he jumps around, but they're all very much De Palma movies. And yeah, he's definitely got his stylistic tropes. You know, he's a lover of the split diopter and Steadicam and a Warner and all these amazing kind of things that make films feel like films that a lot of people just overlook or don't bother with these days. It's great. It was great watching this today. I started watching it last night and got most of it done, and had to finish a bunch off on the tube as well. And just feeling myself being there on the tube, like watching very much a movie. Like it may have been on my phone, but I was like looking over other people, and it's just watching very overly lit TV stuff. And it's just like, hey, I got a classic going on over here, and you can tell this is the real shit. But yeah, I think, like, you know, like sort of manly man stories as well. Like he's got a lot of like these big male figures in the leads of a lot of stuff as well, but then, you know, also stuff like Carrie. So he's jumping around and making it his own.
I guess, like, from starting this deep dive into De Palma, I've probably found, like, I guess, like, there's the obvious Hitchcockian like references he kind of dabbles with in every film, and kind of borrows from the Hitchcock handbook in regards to, like, there's voyeurism in all of his films, whether it's like just using the POV shot, or kind of, I don't know, like, yeah, these the way he films certain things. And I guess, yeah, with this film, it's that first time that Carlito goes into the El Paradiso, and you get that amazing shot with like the narration where he's kind of like looking about and he's going, yeah, it used to be a bit different back in my day. It was all about grass and bell bottoms. Now it's all cocaine and flares and stuff like that. And like that kind of, like the way the camera kind of floats around, I think, like,
yeah,
that's very much like, yeah, the one of the big De Palma like kind of tropes you get. And as you said, the split diopter, him and Stephen H. Burham like kind of go back to that every time, and it's always like, it's visual crack for me. That's like, I kind of, there's like a mental like ticker in my head every time one comes on, like ding, another one, ding, another one. I absolutely love
it. It's somehow able to be very stylistic and also not overly flashy as well. Like, you know, you do have moments where it's, you know, big outlandish kind of like Dutch angles or colors and a vibrancy to it. But also it's just in the craft of stuff. Like we'll get on the big chase towards the end, but there's moments in that where it's just like a big Warner that ends up sort of going down the escalator, like in shot, in this big Steadicam move. And it's something you wouldn't really even think about or notice, and unless you happen to be like, oh, wait a minute, that can't be easy to do. And that's a really cool idea. And there's not just like a cut here. And so there's moments like that throughout most of his films that I've seen that really kind of elevate it all without being overly like, look at me. And then there are the moments that are, look at me. He can do both.
So who wants to take the duty of giving a synopsis for this film? What is this film about? Who wants to jump in on that before I nominate someone?
I'm happy to do that. I should do it, really, to be honest.
Yeah, far away,
the scholar.
Yeah, sure. That's okay. So for anybody who hasn't seen Carlito's Way, It's about a former drug kingpin, Carlito Brigante, who is released from prison early on a legal technicality thanks to his cocaine-addled attorney, Jeffrey Kleinfeld. Vowing to go straight, Carlito takes a job managing a glitzy nightclub. He also rekindles his romance with his old flame, Gail, but Carlito's dream of going legit is undermined at every turn by murderous former cronies and even deadlier young thugs.
That is,
I think that nails
very
it.
Good.
That is beautiful. That is normally, even when I go on podcasts and they've said, like, you need to prepare a synopsis, I just like fumble it and go, I think it's about this. But that was masterful. Oh, thanks for that. So on to some of the stats of this movie. It was released on November 12th, 1993 in the US, and then was released here in the UK on January 7th, 1994. The film stars Al Pacino, Sean Penn, Penelope Ann Miller, John Leguizamo, and Louise Guzman. The budget for this film was $30 million, with a box office return of $63 million. And the film has a hefty 144-minute runtime. A nice long slice. So, yeah, where do you guys, like, who wants to, let's talk about some scenes that you particularly enjoy in this film. Mark, like, we could blow our load and talk about the end first, but, like, is there stuff kind of in the earlier sections of this film that you particularly enjoy?
Yeah, there's loads. I mean, I think everybody knows the first piece of violence that Carlito is embroiled in, which he doesn't want to be in, you know, at the pool table. He sees everything because obviously he's been there before. I mean, that's a great piece as well. And of it, quite funny as well. Let's not forget the fact that it's violent in a sort of De Palma way, but then all of a sudden he's in the toilet. He doesn't know that everybody's been shot and killed. And yet he's got the gun. He's got no bullets, but he thinks, hang on a second, I'm still going to pretend like I'm the big guy here. And, you know, obviously the iconic line of, you know, you're going to die big time. And he comes out and he's ready to go. And then everybody's dead. I mean, it's weird watching it because you're all pumped up, ready for the violence, which happens. And then the payoff is not so much the deaths of the gangsters or anything. The payoff is the joke that he opens the door and everybody else is dead. Now, we've seen it many times before and since in a lot of films. But you don't expect it in a film like this. I think that's the interesting thing about it. And I think De Palma, you know, going back to what you were saying earlier about one of his tropes, is that obviously comedy is not a thing for him, but in Carlito's way, there's quite a lot of humor.
Mm-hmm. I think,
and I'm not sure if people are aware of it.
Yeah, I think he gives Al Pacino definitely time to like breathe and like let him kind of find this character. And like, I love, I've got a very brief clip of him in court where he, like, just the way he, just to get a flavor of the way he talks.
Your Honor, I mean it. This is the truth. I changed, and it didn't take no 30 years like Your Honor thought, but only 5. That's right, sir. 5 years, and look at me. Completely rehabilitated, reinvigorated, reassimilated, and finally going to be relocated. And I want to thank a lot of people for that. I look over there and I see that man there, Mr. Norwalk. I want to thank you, sir.
I just love that. I don't know, it's like a lyrical, like, twang to the way he speaks, especially when he says, I could listen to him say, rehabilitated, like, just like, every, like, on a loop, because it's just fantastic. Yeah, I've got to agree with you that I think there is definitely a humor to this. And it's funny that when De Palma tries to make an out and out comedy, it never works. But when he just makes like a gangster film, they turn out to be funny, or there's humor in
just
his
gotta
other
pepper
films.
It in. That's it.
Yeah.
So, I think that's such an amazing introduction to Carlito's character here and Pacino's performance, because it is undoubtedly big Pacino. But he manages to find a really good line between kind of the big Pacino and also just being quite low talking, like low speaking, like he's someone who listens, he looks and listens a lot. And I think that's what pays off quite a lot in the action scenes when they come. And that that kind of pool hall sequence is so well done. Like the just the slow push in on Pacino's face as he's kind of weighing up, and you can just tell he's got so much like experience and history behind the eyes of this world that he's re-entering, and him just kind of looking around, and it's you know, it's almost like The Godfather with the restaurant scene as well. And just seeing him kind of clock things together, and then just the editing between all the various things going on. And this is something the film does with every big set piece, where in here it's kind of like, you know, we've got young John Ortiz like reaching for the beer in the cooler, the empty cooler, all while Pacino and Carlito is setting up this kind of trick shot to kind of get a bit of an upper hand when shit goes down. And, you know, your boss is dead and so are you. It's such a great fucking line to like kick it all off. And then you suddenly get just these flashes of style where you get, I think it's like a quick split diopter shot, and then the close up on the shades with the knifeman walking between them, between the two eyes. It's just amazing. And it suddenly just explodes and then ends again. And it's such a great way to get straight back into it, where, like, you know, he's been back on the outside for only like 5-10 minutes, and already it's like, oh fuck, there's no escaping.
What's really interesting about that sequence as well is originally when they showed it to the studio, they had like a real problem with it, said it was overly long, and through the editing they kept it the same length, but through the editing you just mentioned, Matt, they kind of managed to keep a kinetic energy to it. It was exactly the same length, and the studio heads kind of went, that's a lot better. Yeah, shorter. It's shorter. And they're like, it's not. But we've just like kind of, we've managed to fool you. And like, it's almost like, and what's fascinating about it is the way that he says, like, I think Carlito says, I've got it written down here. He's like, this ain't a trick. This is magic time. Like when he's saying about like the, what he's going to do with the pool trick. And it's kind of, you're getting that with the movie making as well. It's like, we're going to show you a scene that, I don't know, could be yeah, done in a boring way. And I think that's throughout this film. Like, I kind of picked up on, there is a moment like early on in the film when they first go to like a nightclub, Kleinfeld and Carlito. And like they're chatting. One, he gets them dancing whilst they're chatting. But then like, even when they're just chatting at the bar, the camera's kind of just like floating around the room. And it's not just kind of like a boring 1-2-1-2 shot. Do you know what I mean? There's something a bit more going on with it, that it's like, I don't know, to watch it as like a movie fan, it's kind of like, oh, the performances are great, but then it's like, we're gonna give you a chance to like, we're gonna give a bit of pizzazz with like the actual movie making as well, because like, it's like De Palma knows like exposition can be a bit boring.
There's something I want to mention, actually. Well, I want to pick up on what Matt said was about the eyes. And I write about it in my book quite a bit, about how De Palma frames Pacino's eyes quite a lot in this film. More than anything else, it is about the eyes. Obviously, you know, the eyes don't lie, Chico. But it's kind of interesting how it's so close on everything. Like, you think he's going to do it once or twice, but it's not. It's all the way through. It starts like that because obviously it starts with Carlito on the gurney. It ends with Carlito on the gurney as well, and the way that it's framed there. And there are numerous times where it just picks up on Pacino's eyes, which is really interesting as well, because obviously he's got that huge hair, which is beautifully manicured and everything else. And he's got this beard as well, which is, you know, I mean, it's close to yours, Petros, the beard. It's close.
It all looks amazing in profile.
Exactly, yes.
It's very boot polished beard, right? It's like, it's boot polished on as well.
But when you look at Carlito, the only thing that you can really see are his eyes. Everything else is covered with hair. And De Palma decides, right, I'm going to focus on this all the way through, and Pacino is going to act with his eyes. And we know he's capable of that because he's done it in The Godfather. He did it in, he did it in Serpico as well, Dog Day Afternoon as well. I mean, he's done it throughout his entire bloody life. But it's interesting, you see it more in Carlito's way than you do in any of the other movies. And I think that just goes to show the connection that Pacino and De Palma had, well, you know, since working on Scarface and then going on to this film as well, is that they decided, let's change it up. Let's not make it about showing all of Pacino. Let's narrow it down to something. And, you know, I think it's exemplified in One of my favorite scenes, actually, one of my all-time favorite scenes in this movie is when Carlito is obviously hugely in love with Penelope Ann Miller's character, and she's keeping him at arm's length, and he goes to her apartment and she keeps the chain on, and he's just sort of peering through that little gap, and she's slowly taking her clothes off away. And it, once again, the camera just focuses in on Pacino's face, and all you can see is the eyes. And you're like, this is a man who is in love. You kind of forget that he's a gangster. That's the thing. And I write about that in the book, is that this is a romance film. This is not a crime movie. Take the crime bits out, the fact that he used to be a gangster and, you know, he's still got some nefarious people around him. Take that out. This is a romance film.
Mm-hmm.
Pure and simple.
And I think what it cleverly does, and from knowing previous like big Pacino performances from before, is obviously like we get a feeling from other characters from his past life that that's how he used to be. Like, he used to be a big swinging dick on the streets. And I think someone says to him about like the way Benny Blanco is. He's like, that was you. I think Sasso says to him, that was you 20 years ago. And it's like, oh, so it's got that like almost like meta subtext to it, where it's like, we could definitely see Pacino being that big brash guy. But this, yeah, and like you said, it is a love story. What's that kind of needle drop you get in that scene where, yeah, I've kind of dubbed it so horny he breaks the lock scene. And it's there's a needle drop at the end. I can't take my eyes off of you. It is.
But it comes back at the end. I think it's earlier as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It's like, it's an amazing thing. Like, you know, I think there are some explicit parallels, but this very much is sort of Pacino and De Palma's Casablanca in a way, you know, because he's a guy escaping like a past. He has this past romance that he's trying to rekindle. He owns a bar. He mentions at one point he's Humphrey Bogarting it around. And it's very true. It's like, you know, about all this colorful cast of characters around him trying to, in this film, you know, bring him back to his old ways. And I think as well as that, it's about someone who is just incapable of seeing how the world's kind of moved on. And it's quite, you know, it's a tragedy as well, where when you can't see that you're now the old man, or you're too arrogant to accept it, that, you know, someone else might be coming up behind you doing the exact same shit that you did before. And obviously back then when that was you, you pushed ahead with that and thought you were the hot shit, and now you're so fully yourself here. And it's interesting that it's not because he's someone out to get back on top of the gangster food chain. Like, he's not out of prison trying to reclaim like a territory. He is explicitly trying to get out the whole time and just do what he can, but he can't let go of the way he approaches like the next generation, essentially. And and, you know, for anyone kind of getting on a bit and recognizing the youth around you, it's just like, oh man, yeah, he needs to open his eyes and see that this is going to bite him in the ass.
Yeah. That whole, like,
there's a you know, going back to the romance thing as well, is that it is rare, you know, that we see a film that has so much red hot romance in it. Let's be honest. I mean, the romance between Carlito and Gail is very sexy, very sexy. And it's rare to see something like that when the two actors playing that were having an affair at the same time.
Oof. Yeah. Yeah. I think I've read about that. And apparently when it came to the premiere of this film, Al Pacino kind of didn't even look at her. Do you know what I mean? Like, his big bulging eyes didn't go anywhere near her. Like, it's like, oh, I better go with my wife.
Well, I mean, at the time, Pacino's with Lyndall Hobbs, who, British actress, director as well. He was with her for a long, long time. And then obviously they were having an affair. The press found out as well and hounded Penelope Ann Miller. Didn't hound Pacino at all, but hounded her all about it. You know, but going back to it, obviously, they were having this passionate love affair. We can't comment on, you know, I'm not going to comment on private matters. I mean, that's you know, that's for newspapers and, you know, gossip rags. But it is rare to see so much passion on screen and then know that it was the same off screen as well.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's really interesting to hear something like that when you tell people that, yes, they were having an affair. Normally, you know, the on-screen romance is a bit lackluster. You're kind of like, yeah, it's all right, but no, not this, not this.
Yes, white hot, right?
Yeah. Well, their chemistry is amazing, and you know, there is a 24-year age gap between them as well, and so it's like, you know, for one thing that could maybe mess with screen chemistry, the real life affair off is maybe fueling it back up again. So it ends up being this really unique powder keg mix between them, and yeah, you totally believe it the whole way.
Well, one thing when we talk about the cast in this, one bit of information I came across at one point before Sean Penn like stepped in to play Kleinfeld, there was a version of this film with Marlon Brando attached to play Kleinfeld, and Elliot Kastner, the producer, ended up trying to file a lawsuit against Al Pacino because he was supposed to do his version of A Carlito Story, which, like, I think this is based on the book After Hours, I think it's called. Like, the book's called After Hours, but obviously they couldn't call the film After Hours because that obviously had already been taken by Martin Scorsese. So, what do you guys think of Sean Penn in this? And what do you think of a world where Marlon Brando is in Carlito's Way? What do you think about that, Matt?
That's bloody wild. Like, I love Sean Penn in this. I think he's really good. And it's clearly a part that, you know, has inspired so much, because obviously there's GTA Vice City, of course, inspired a lot with Scarface and this film. There's a character in that very much based on him. But also Paul Kaye's comedy creation, Mike Strutter, which I'm a big fan of, which is just blatantly Kleinfeld as the coked-up lawyer with frizzy hair and doing the exact same accent. But he's great, and it's a really truly strong supporting performance, where he has this sort of parallel story throughout and all these little twists and turns as well. And he just gives it such genuine, jittery, cocky energy, you know, going from... you know, shagging Benny's girl at the club, and then just swinging his dick around in front of the floor, and then just being all pissed off with people on his lawn at his party, and then getting further and further into it, and the shit-eating grin on his face when, by the time Carlito's saying, you know, you're not a lawyer no more, you're a gangster, you're on the other side, it's different now, and he's just like, yeah, I'll be fine. It's just that you can't wait to see him get his comeuppance, and you know, the way that unfolds, I'm sure we'll talk on, is beautiful.
Well, I love, like, the kind of the beginning of his kind of downfall, right, is when he visits Tony in at Riker's, which I think, like, gives me one of my favorite shots in this film, which is like one of those moments where you see a director do something where it's like, you are just flexing your muscles here, you didn't have to do that. But it's that kind of that tracking shot of him walking down the gangway to Riker's Island. And then the camera keeps going out and out and out, and you realize, oh, this is a helicopter shot. And then the camera just swings round to reveal Riker's Island. And it's just a real, like, you know what I mean? Like, De Palma going, I've fucking still got it, guys. I know you gave me a hard time for Casualties of War and Bonfire of the Vanities, but I can still pull it out of the bag here in the early 90s.
No drones back then. Wasn't that easy.
we'll get on to some of the... I think this film took a long time to film. I know that they said it started in the winter and got all the way to the summer of filming, and Al Pacino had definitely regretted the fact that his character has a leather jacket on all the time. And I think when they were filming some of the, like, subway stuff later on in the film, he just got fed up one day and just, like, got on the subway and went home. Like, when they were supposed to be filming, because it was like, too fucking hot, we've been doing such long days, I fucking had enough of this. Mark, what do you think of Sean Penn as Kleinfeld in this?
I mean, if Sean Penn's Kleinfeld is basically Tony Montana with a job, that's it. You know, if Tony Montana wasn't gunned down and decided to go legit, that would kind of be him, I think. And I think that's why you've got that wonderful crisscross from Carlito's Way to Scarface, because there is an instantly likable and then an instantly dislikable person in both of them. Kleinfeld, I think, you know, let's be honest, in another world, that could have been Pacino, because it is that larger-than-life character that Pacino liked to do, especially in the 90s, where, you know, he was shouting and whatever else. That could have been Pacino. It could have been role reversed. but it's not. And I kind of like the fact that Sean Penn goes all out. I mean, you mentioned Casualties of War a minute ago. That's one of my favorite war films of all time. I think it's amazing. And Sean Penn's brilliant in that. And, you know, he hounded Michael J. Fox by calling him a TV actor all the way through that. I love that piece of trivia. I think it's amazing. But, you know, in this one, it's just so extravagant. And it goes back to what I was saying in that, you know, way De Palma would film it. His style is like aggressive. And I think Penn picked up on that. And obviously, let's not forget that at that time, I think Penn was heavily involved with Madonna. And obviously there was all the, you know, the fighting going on at the premieres and everything else like that. So Sean Penn was already coming with this sort of attitude of he's going to beat the shit out of you, whether it's in the film or in real life as well. But I just think it's a wonderful performance. It's so over the top. And yet at the same time, it's kind of in keeping with what you would expect somebody to be like that at that time. You know, you don't think it's out of place at any point. You know, you were mentioning there actually about Steffi, who's obviously the girl in the scene. Well, I interviewed the young lady who played Steffi, and she said, you know, working next to Pacino and Penn was fantastic. They were both very, very giving. And she had no problems whatsoever. She you know, was very happy to be part of that world and actually got to really enjoy it. And I think that's something interesting, is that you look at somebody like Sean Penn giving this type of performance, you think, God, I bet it was an absolute bloody nightmare working opposite this guy. But then when you have somebody who was treated like shit, to be honest with you, you know, that character is treated like shit by Kleinfeld, and the actress says, it was a really good, you know, it was a really good experience for me. I think that shows when you have actors who are all working on the same level and know what they want to do with this character. You know, I think we've all heard the stories, the horror stories of method actors thinking it's method and it's not, there's some people
you're just
out there
being a dick.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. You know, there's some people think they're doing method. You're like, you're really not, you know, Pacino does method. Brando did method. Some of this stuff is not method. So, I just think it's such an outlandish performance. And I think probably Penn had such a good time doing it as well. If he didn't, there was something wrong, because it did seem like he's having such a good time of going, I'm just going to go all out crazy.
Mm-hmm. I think there was only one kind of dispute between De Palma and Penn on this film. And like, Penn just wanted to keep going on a certain scene, and Palmer's like, we've got it. And like, I think De Palma, from watching him in an interview, seems like he doesn't really give a shit. Like, do you know what I mean? He's kind of like, I don't really care. Like, he said he was like, he called him up that night to continue having a go at him. Like, he was like, I just wanted another take. And he's like, we've got to fucking move on. Like, there's a lot to do in this movie. But I think Penn's great. And I love the fact that he decided that, like, to shave his own hair back to get that kind of balding look, like, for the Kleinfeld look. And it's, I don't know, it just makes, as a balding man, like, yeah, there's something, I don't know, inherently, like, shade, especially when your hair's long. I think people who have long hair and it's balding always look a little bit sinister, whether it is Warren Ellis or not. Well, is there anything else we should talk about before we get to the kind of climactic moment of this? That is kind of what, about half hour? The last half hour of this film is kind of all go,
well, I guess,
go, go, go.
I guess
go.
With Kleinfeld as well, you've got two other amazing instances of great editing. First, when he's about to be stabbed outside the lift, and this is again, and that more really great moments to do with eyes and close-ups with him just looking from. It's great when you have a scene like this and the director has, you know, picked a certain thing within the location to kind of focus on, here being the little light for the lift coming down, and just the build-up again of tension of being like, something's coming, and Kleinfeld's kind of onto it, and he keeps having that looking down the corridor where it's that kind of like long shot, and you're seeing who's coming, and it's kind of like people start off far away enough that you squint a bit and you're like, is this normal? Is this someone? And then back to the light, which is up close, and then back to long again, and all this. And he's next to that big guy right next to him as well. And then finally, the the sort of, you know, knifeman comes out behind the woman right when the lifts open as well. So it's like a raptor attack, you know, it's both sides. And that's just an amazing piece of build up as well. And then of course, you know, when he gets got in the hospital room, when you realize Carlito took the bullets, and it's just that amazing kind of cut between of the bullets in the trash and adios, counselor, and then it's just perfect, the reveals, because I think it gets to his empty gun clicking first before, and that's when he realizes, this is when we realize, and it's just an amazing synchronicity.
Well, I know that there was a big problem for Pacino and Penn regarding the fact, like, neither of them believed that Carlito would actually go back to the hospital, like, for them, like, and like, I know David Kep had to keep rewriting until they were both happy, because it is one of those things where if you kind of look at it under the microscope, it is that thing of like, the guy wanted to get out of town, so why the hell would he go to that hospital? And I know it works for the film because it creates like this pressure cooker thing, and very cleverly as well, kind of, it's so high stakes and high pressure at that moment that you don't even think about it. Do you know what I mean? You just chalk it down to whether it's...
I think that's maybe like the
code of
honor. I think it's maybe like the last remnant of the old Carlito, where it's like, you know, you see how much he feels betrayed when he has to listen to that recording in the, you know, with the cops. And it's like, you know, he's been trying to get out this whole time, and this is maybe the one time, you know, he kind of feels obliged to like help with the mission on the boat to go save/kill the main gangster guy. But here it feels like, oh, if I'm going to do one thing, it's going to be, you know, no one betrays me like this. So he's getting some real sweet revenge, because setting up a fall as opposed to even doing it yourself is pretty cold. And he would have got away with it too if it wasn't for these pesky, well, not kids, but many, many pesky surrounding Italians forces closing in.
I think, you know, you were saying, is there anybody else we should talk about? We should mention John Leguizamo as Benny Blanco from the Bronx, because he does kind of forget. It does kind of get forgotten about a little bit when you're talking about Carlito's Way, because obviously Pacino and Sean Penn and De Palma. But really, you know, it's such a great performance, because he comes in as the cock of the walk, very much on the same level as Kleinfeld. And he stays like that all the way through. As you were saying earlier, Matt, you know, you've got this young one who's coming up and trying to take over. And he's a guy who you're never sure about at any point. You know that he's going to be trouble. That's fine. But there are times where you're like, who is this guy? What is he doing? You know, where's he coming from? I can't really get a handle on him at all. And then there are other times where you're like, okay, this guy is just a mean motherfucker. Yeah. And, you know, he's happy to carry a gun into a nightclub. And, you know, it all culminates in a really smart bit of assassination at the end. Let's be honest, you know, the way he thought about doing the broken arm and using that as the gun is a very clever way. And then leaning in and obviously delivering the line as well. And I just think it's a very, very good performance that John Leguizamo never gets enough recognition for at all, which is a shame, because it is, you know, I think there are a lot of performances out there, certainly in crime movies, that have copied Benny Blanco and they've never really said it, because it is that type of performance that you can easily copy and slightly tweak. But John Leguizamo was there doing it.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's an amazing piece of casting, because you're right. He does kind of come across as someone who could be someone playing gangster a bit, who's a bit out of his depth, but also being quite sinister, and he plays that really, really well. And I think it might even be almost like a case of the rule of three as well, where you see him like once and twice, and then by the time you see him the third time, it's him, you know, getting thrown out, and that so deliberately feels like the end of that subplot, because that's kind of all it is at this point. So it's such an amazing way to make you forget about him. Because even though, you know, he said outright, like, I'm going to kill you, we already know that Luis Guzman is spying for him. So you got all these kind of clues. And I think the genius of the way it plays into the finale is, because the finale is so lengthy and so focused on, like, the Italians, it does make you forget about Benny. And so they play all these different you know, complications up when it comes to will he escape or not. And by the time you kind of think he's free, of course it's Benny that steps in. It's that genius kind of twist ending where it's like, it was right there the whole time, but when watching it, you don't quite see it. And that's saying it as a film that literally opens with the shooting. So you knew, you definitely knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And watching
it
back, you can, at the beginning, you can see it's Benny, but obviously you don't know him yet and he's in a different colored suit and everything. But it's, you know, it's a film that gets to do the classic, yep, that's me. You're probably wondering how I ended up here, opening, but does it exactly how it should be. And this is De Palma playing in, I wouldn't even call it, you know, cliche now, maybe this kind of structure, but just making it work in the context of the film and story so elegantly.
Well, I think it's interesting to the point of De Palma's career as well, because obviously, as we said, like Casualties of War and Bonfire of the Vanities probably left him a little bit jaded. And you see around this time, 92, 93, he very much returns to the films with subject matter that he knows so well. So like with Raising Kane, a film I discussed on the last episode, it is him kind of doing a greatest hits of his kind of Hitchcockian thrillers. And then this is very much, he's going, right, we've got stuff. I'm going back to the gangster world. So I'm taking a bit of the Untouchables. I'm taking a bit of what I did with Scarface and kind of making it this kind of, I don't know, like epic. This kind of feels like his epic, right? This is like definitely the longest De Palma film out there, I believe.
Do you know, it's interesting you use the word epic, which is a word that I don't think anybody uses for Carlito's Way, even though it is 2.5 hours, and even though it is ultimately quite epic. I think people don't use it because epic normally means obviously a long movie, but also it means huge vast landscapes and huge cinematography and everything else like that. And people don't think about Carlito's Way like that because it was shot predominantly in New York and because it was shot in very close quarters. People don't think about it like that, but really, you're right, it probably is epic. You know, you think about the shot on top of the roof where it's raining and Carlito's got the trash can over the head looking at Gale from afar. I mean, that's a wonderful piece of cinematography. Right up there with a lot of stuff that would be classed as amazing cinematography, but I think it kind of gets forgotten about because it's such a it's in a close-knit community rather than anything else. You know, it's not going out into the vast world. Okay, yes, Gale ends up going to you know, a very nice island on Carlito's money, but at the same time, it's not like that. That's the thing. I think the only time, I mean, obviously, we're going to talk about it now, I guess, but the only time a lot of people would say epic is that final half an hour, which deserves the word epic, really. But I do think you're right there, Petros, that it is an epic film. There's no two ways about it, but I just don't think people call it that at all, which is a bit of a shame.
I think it very much leans on the kind of noirish tropes as well. I'm always reminded of that moment when they take Benny out into the alley. And the way that alley's lit and stuff like that, it looks like a kind of like, and even the way, I don't know, it's kind of like noir through, very much through the lens of Brian De Palma. Cause like the like, instead of dark shadow, sometimes it's like that bit in the hallway before he throws him down the stairs. It's like just that red light, but then you still got the shadows and stuff like that. And then it goes into the alley, which looks like it should just be covered in smoke as well. Or even the kind of, I don't know, the big rescue / murder at Rikers, like, is just bellowed in smoke and stuff like that. And kind of, I think.
You can picture it happening in the 40s, can't you? In, you know, 4x3 in black and white, especially out on the boat. It's, it feels off the time.
If you just transpose this plot just about like a gangster, like get rid of the heroin, like subplot and stuff like that. This could be if they had said Scarface and Carlito's Way were both remakes of kind of classic gangster films from like the 30s, I would go, yeah, you like, of course they are, like, because Carlito's Way, it feels like it, and it's like, as I said, it feels like a noir, and he's, as you said, he says he's Humphrey Bogart in it, and it's like he knows what he's doing. Yeah, I think it's really grand, and epic. I think that's like, yeah, when I say epic, it just feels grand. Like, even though, like you said, Mark, it is kind of all quite close knit within New York. And I guess the big grand set piece of this film is the grand central chase. But before we get to that moment, a moment I love is that tension that's built up when the three Italian or four Italian dudes come and visit Carlito at the club, and we get, like, again, I think it's a Brian De Palma like trope trick, is that the camera just spinning around in a circle, kind of all the faces and like background again, just kind of, yeah, that's a beautiful shot. But like that, the tension from there on out kind of is squeaky bum time, right? Up until that shot that takes Carlito's life, right? Yeah.
If you look carefully, obviously George Porcel is in that, who plays Sosa. If you look carefully, you can see him reading the lines off a piece of card because he didn't speak English. He had no clue about English. So if you look carefully, you can see his eyes just move to the right a little bit when he's speaking, and he's phonetically saying it. So that's why when he's in there, when he speaks in the films, it's a struggle at times because he didn't speak English at all. But De Palma thought, let's put him in there because he'd seen him on TV and he thought he was a funny guy. So they put him in there not knowing that he didn't speak English at all.
That's amazing. Yeah. What do you make of that kind of those moments in the club, Matt? Like when he's trying to get the money and he's trying to escape, like.
They're all so great. All the club scenes are amazing, whether it's, you know, tension boiling up between, sort of rebuffing Benny's gestures of goodwill or moments like this, or when, Sean Penn is deliberately kind of picking a fight with the guy dancing with, what's the name?
Gail.
With Gail, yeah. And then into this end bit when this is where the chase kind of starts, really, and it starts off being deliberately claustrophobic and oppressive because it's really leans into that feeling of knowing that everyone wants you dead, basically, and, like, you know, your time's running out. And Pacino, again, given some amazing kind of back and forth face acting. And I think, you know, the camera knows this, and so swirling around, it's never kind of cutting away to give you any kind of break, and I love that he kind of escapes out of, you know, the smallest kind of little hatch in there before, like, birthing out onto the street, and then it just carries on. And of course, you know, this is an incredible, like, disco movie. And it's funny, like you said, how it feels like a 40s noir, and it's also so very much like a 70s scuzzy New York film. Like, I don't think of it as a 90s film at all. Like, I often have to remind myself that it's 1993 because, you know, it feels like it could be genuinely a 70s American De Palma movie with an older Pacino somehow. And it's just amazing. I can't picture, like, present day 90s making it look 70s with giving it this 40s feel. Like, it's an amazing kind of timeless kind of sheen over this whole thing. It's great.
I think that is a filmmaker, right, who knows his film history to be able to, like, filter that stuff through by making it feel like the times in which, like, it's evoking, whether it is, like, set in the 70s but having that 40s thing. And Brian De Palma, I watched an interview with him recently, and he kind of said, like, especially around the 90s, he's like, and I guess he's making barbs at people like Tarantino, because he's kind of saying, like, everyone's kind of, like, cutting and pasting their references. And, like De Palma kind of can't really say that in one regard, because obviously he's just aped Hitchcock for most of his career and kind of taken stuff wholesale from him. But, like, I think I know what he does mean in a way. Do you know what I mean? In that regards to, he likes to think, he must think about himself, that he is very much like, he knows that stuff so well that it's embedded, and it's a part of his DNA, where it's not like, I don't know, this shot is exactly from this movie. It's kind of, yeah, De Palma has managed to be the torchbearer, I think, from Hitchcock, as opposed to being I don't know, like his shadow as such. But yeah, Mark, what do you think of that chase? Like, yeah, what did you have any insights? Did you speak to anyone who was involved with this chase, or what did you write about it in the book?
No, I didn't speak to anybody who was involved in it. I only spoke to the young lady who played Steffi. But I mean, that foot chase. So I had to find out quite a bit about it, because obviously it's a bit that everybody knows, whether you've seen the film or not. You know, I think The Simpsons have ripped it off millions of times, so everybody knows it through that anyway. But it was shot over several months. It wasn't all done in, you know, one fluid motion or anything else like that. They started it in the winter. They finished it in the middle of summer. So you can imagine how sweaty Pacino was at that time. You know, you had mentioned earlier that he decided to go home at one point, and he did. But it starts, I mean, for anybody who knows the geography of New York, they'll probably understand this a bit more then. So it starts at Brooklyn, Smith and 9th Street Station, which was actually playing Broadway and 7th. Goes through the escalators of the Grand Central Station. And at the time, because they were filming, they had to reroute all the subway trains and reorder them as well. So if they had to come in to Grand Central, they had to time it so they weren't filming as well. That, you know, so it was all, you know, timing and everything. And part of the problem was obviously trying to keep it so it looked like it was still the same time period when they'd shot some bits in the winter, some bits in the summer. So you kind of have to make sure that Pacino's not sweating and not cold in the other one as well. But obviously the long tracking shot was actually fudged. It should have been longer. I don't think people know this, but it was fucked up at the last minute by a first AD who... had taken a wrong sign to basically pan over to Pacino before he was ready for that one moment. So they actually had to stop filming. And then they decided, well, we haven't got time to redo this at all because of the amount that's going into it, you know, resetting it all the way back. It's going to have to be fixed in the editing suite. So that scene alone could have been longer. If somebody hadn't...
That's incredible to have a mistake like that, and it still is incredible. Like, you wouldn't know. You wouldn't be like, oh, I see what they're trying to do, but it's a fail. It's like, that is a good save. They're lucky they could save it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was saved. I'll tell you how it was saved. It was saved by a cutaway to one of the guys who was chasing him. So when you watch it again, you don't really notice it. This is the thing. You're constantly thinking this is one long take, and that's the clever thing. And all of us have seen one-shot movies, and then months or years later, we found out, oh, they had a bloody edit in there. Oh, God, they did that really well. And that's the same with Carlito's Way. You look at it and you think this is one huge tracking shot. There is a cutaway to somebody, but because it's been so long, your brain doesn't quite register that it's cut away. Instead, it just continues going, yes, yes, it's the same camera, it's doing the same thing, it's changing rounds. So it's a very clever edit, really. But in terms of the scene itself, I mean, that it's just so intense, yeah. Isn't it? Even the bit where he's laid down on the escalator and you're thinking, he's got away with this. And then the fat guy who's out of breath, I mean, God bless that guy, really, because that would have been me, to be honest with you. You know, running across there and trying, you know, he sees him at the last minute and you're like, oh, my God, we're back into it again. So you have that brief respite where you think he's got away with it. Carlito's away. He's going to meet Gail. This is the moment. And then it starts again. And you're like, how do you keep this level of intensity? But that's the clever thing about Brian De Palma. He keeps that level of intensity for what? 40 minutes.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I think they needed to, especially with the escalators, they needed to keep that level of tension, because I know that the editors, and they need a massive shout out on this. It's Christina Bowden and Bill Pankow, who managed to because they were worried about the geography of the escalators, or just the kind of how long, do you know what I mean? Somebody cutting away from it, people would be like, how long is that escalator? So they had to kind of really figure it out in the edit so people can kind of keep it, again, quite kinetic and moving and using quicker edits. So your brain didn't have that opportunity to go, wait a second, it was halfway down the escalator and now we've gone to this, because it goes to that amazing bird's eye view shot of him kind of laying on the escalator. And by that time he's in the middle of it, and it's like, I'm sure when he passed when he passed like the gangster on the other side, he was near the middle. It's like he would have been
yeah,
at the
yeah, definitely
bottom.
Wasn't that long because like, we went down it in real time with the Steadicam. So it's like, you know, whoosh.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. It's like, you know, there's so many great complications to this whole scene, and that's great writing and filmmaking. You know, you got to make it hard for your characters. It'd be all too easy to just have like a pretty simple chase if one or two things that go wrong. And the way to, I think, to really up the tension is to make it seem like it's now going right. Now it's going wrong again. And, you know, throughout this whole thing, you've got him from once he's out of the bar, you've got those guys on the platform holding up the train, which allows the others to catch up with him. You've got Carlito hiding behind the cops, using the cops as kind of like a shield, and then hiding behind the balloons, and then sort of basically escaping when he gets to the top of the escalator, but needing to go down the same way they've gone. So it's like, you know, if this was any other situation, he could escape, but he needs to go where they've gone. So that's like, fuck. And then, of course, you know, it is the big fat guy who kind of like the one who couldn't chase him and was, again, like Benny, almost forgotten about since we saw a quick glimpse of him on the train. It comes to him to be the one to discover him again, just through sheer circumstance of where he is. And then, you know, by the time it finally looks like he's escaping, then you hit him with a Benny. And, you know, someone who's not even a part of the chase, but who's been the smoking gun all along. And I think, you know, as we said, I think that reveal of him, it's one of the best reveals, you know, in cinema. It's incredible.
Yeah. I have to make note of the fact that a mutual friend of ours, Matt, Liam H. Dempsey, sent me a letterbox list that he has, which is called I think it's something like it's called the Benny from the Bronx list, and it's basically films where a character who's established in the first act disappears for the rest of the film and then murders the protagonist at the end of the movie. And I do have to blame him slightly because I ruined two films for myself. The other two films on that list I have not seen, so I'm now like, ah. So, yeah, look at that list at your own peril. I might put it in the show notes for this episode.
So it's interesting you were saying earlier, Petros, about De Palma, Hitchcock ripping off and everything. In my book, I always put what the critics had written about the film. So I always picked out like three quotes from, you know, some of the classic film critics from back in the day. The New York Times said, Mr. De Palma ends his film with a sequence Hitchcock might have envied.
Oh, that's got to be like a, he's got to have had a good night's sleep that night, right? After reading that. Oh, De Palma.
So I finally did it. I beat him.
Well, I mean, you say that, and I would be the same. I'd be like, look at that, get that on the wall. However, the Chicago Reader said, if Brian De Palma has made a duller movie than this 144-minute snooze fest, I count myself fortunate to have missed it.
Wow, that is...
Gives with one hand, takes with the other. Oh.
Yes! Critics, what do they know? The fucking bastards.
I think if I was a famous filmmaker who was making big films, I'd need to see like the absolute like bootlicking praise review to get a bit of the ego, and then the one that just fucking hates it and be like, if I can have those two for everything I make, I've got no reason to complain. So I'm like, cool. I know there's two sides to this. I can never have to be annoyed at it.
So is there anything else that we kind of need to talk about in this? Oh, I think there's something I wanted to bring up, and it's quite interesting in regards to the fact that that moment when he throws Benny down the stairs, because it all really ties into it. It's like, I love the fact that that is the opportunity to, like, he could get out then. He could avoid what is inevitable fate at the end of this if he just stepped back into his own world. And it is like I think he says earlier in the film, he says to Gail, it will be just my luck that, like, everything will go, like, somebody will bring a gun into the club and we'll get shut down. And I love that seed, like the seeding throughout, whether it is like her saying that's not the guy I used to know. And like, because obviously we have no reference point to who Carlito used to be 5 years before he went in prison. But I love that the film gives you so much like kind of little breadcrumbs, as opposed to big, like, kind of, I don't know, you don't have to hear somebody go on a big story of the stuff he used to do. You just kind of get little bits here and there, whether it's like, hey, you used to have eight, like 9,000 guys on the street.
And that's
you?
What builds the character. That's what builds the mystique, you know. not everything needs to be explained away and backstoried out and franchised away. It's like, this is it. Some people, half of the thrill of the character is not knowing, because you get through context clues who they are. Like, you get it. You don't need it all spelled out. And it's great. And I believe there is a prequel to this, isn't there, from 2005, The Rise to Power, which I haven't seen, which I think covers some of the other books, or at least maybe the first half of them, you know, some of the older stuff. But yeah, no interest. No interest
so,
there.
Yeah, so that film actually is based on the book Carlito's Way.
Yeah.
And then obviously Carlito's Way is the book, the second...
The After Hours.
Edwin Torres, yeah, book, yeah. After Hours. So like, yeah, I've got no... I think I've seen it on a CEX shelf and kind of... I've spat at it and walked away. Disappointed, because I saw the Carlito's Way font. I was like, oh, I've got Carlito's Way. I need to get that on physical. And then like realised, oh, it's the prequel. No, thank you.
We should mention, actually, this is one thing we should mention, because it's not brought up that much, is that obviously, as you were saying earlier, Petros, that the producer filed a lawsuit before the film was even made. The film actually ended with a lawsuit thrown against it as well, because American lawyer Alan Dershowitz, who in the past has represented people like Mike Tyson and Jeffrey Epstein, threatened to sue De Palma and Penn and Universal because he thought Jeffrey Kleinfeld was based on him. Now, that takes some big-headedness to think of yourself of, yeah, you see that guy who's like a self-destructive, narcissistic, coke-headed lawyer.
This is unlicensed biopic. How dare they?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, it didn't go anywhere, basically. It never went before the court. Because how do you take something like that to court and turn around and go, yes, well, you see the scenes where he's taking drugs. Here's some photos of me taking drugs as well. And here's me laundering some money as well. And that time when I killed somebody as well. Yes. That's all copied on me. So I do find it interesting. I mean, films are always subjected to lawsuits after they come out anyway. You know, I had the idea of this and whatever else. But I find it interesting that a high-profile American lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, tried to sue because he thought Kleinfeld was based on him.
I'm actually looking at a photo of Alan Dershowitz right now. And the only thing I think, yeah. Like, if the stuff about his personal life and what he got up to away from it, he does look a little bit like the Kleinfeld character. He is a balding man with kind of pre-balding Larry David. Like, if you ever seen those old photos when he used to have big like curly hair, he kind of looks a bit like that, but he's dressed like Mr. Bean in this photo that I've got right now. So what a bizarre talk about ratting on yourself. Do you know what I mean? Like, kind of going, yeah, that's based on me. That's
a lose-lose, isn't it? Either you lose a lawsuit or you win it, but at what cost? Like, yes, this is me.
I'm pointing out the fact that you are a piece of shit. just going through my notes here to double check if there's anything that we've missed. I guess we just have to mention quickly the score of this film, because it's Patrick Doyle. Music is phenomenal, and we're not even like that's not even talking about the kind of needle drops we get through this kind of.
So many needle drops.
The perfectly placed ones as well. When you get Viggo Mortensen, who is in this film, Aragorn himself. In the background in the club, you can hear the OJ's Backstabbers like playing, and it's like perfect because obviously like he's come in, this guy who's clearly a rat, and Carlito's kind of sussed him out straight away, right? He's like oh yeah, how comes you're out of prison so quickly? And he's like, oh, like you, I got in with the right guys, I read a lot of books and stuff like that. And then we get the reveal of The Wire and stuff like that. But I think, yeah, just that kind of that using that needle drop in the background is perfect.
It's so weird because me and the Spotlight Boys used to make these short films. We made one in between uni years back in like 2005, and used Got to Be Real by Cheryl Lynn, probably because we'd seen it in this, heard it in this. And at that time, you know, this film was only 12 years old, and it's now been longer since we made that film than it has since that film was out when we made that film. It's just like, oh, God, time.
And the thing is, as well, is with some of those tracks, not the score, but the tracks that they use, they could so easily have used more popular songs from that period. You know, you see films now that just use the most popular ones because everybody knows them. And that that's going to appeal to a mass market. Whereas Carlito's Way is a little bit more sophisticated in its song choices. In the ones where you go, okay, this is I like this song. Who is it? I vaguely recall it. It's that sort of choice where they've gone, let's not go for the obvious. Let's go for something else. Myself and Alan Jones, who is obviously one of the co-directors of Fright Fest here in the UK, we've had long discussions about the brilliant use of disco music in this, because Alan's a big disco fan and has written for lots of inlays for disco compilations. And we both agree it's one of the best movies to display real disco, as in, you know, the location and the choices. Because there are places, you know, there's films out there that just go, oh, it's hit after hit after hit after hit. And you go, that's not how it works in a club. You know, they would be playing something that now is classed as shit because it was of that time period.
Yeah.
But this, you listen to it and you go, it's a hit. But at the same time, it probably wasn't at the time, but now it's sort of come back into vogue and everything. And, you know, myself and Alan have spoken about it at length of this is one of the best disco films, even though it's not a disco film. It's a romance, as I said earlier.
I think it would make a weird triple bill, but kind of somehow fit this Saturday Night Fever and Spike Lee's Son of Sam. I think all three kind of, because I always look at Son of Sam being like what was happening elsewhere in New York when Saturday Night Fever was happening, because it was, 1977, I think, was when that all that shit was going down. So it's kind of another side of the coin. And then you've got a couple of years earlier, you've got Carlito's Way kind of happening again in a similar area. What's this supposed to be like? Is it Harlem, like the barrio and stuff like that? And like, yeah, it seems like they perfectly paint these portraits of New York in the 70s, but only one of them was made in the 70s. The other two are the 90s movies, which I think is crazy. So let's move on to is there any Hitchcock, out and out Hitchcock references that either of you picked up on in this film?
It's probably littered with it, but then everybody's been ripping off Hitchcock for decades anyway. That's the thing, you know, you watch a film nowadays, it could be anything, you go, well, that's a Hitchcock reference, let's be honest. So it, as much as you're trying to point us in the direction here, Petros, and trying to get us to say something, the answer is just about every film since Hitchcock has got some sort of Hitchcock reference in it. Some are more obvious than others, but, you know, as we said earlier, De Palma loves Hitchcock. And if he can be compared to him, or even said, I can better him, then I think he's a very happy chap.
Matt, is there anything that you picked up on that is overtly kind of a homage to Hitchcock in any way in this film?
As we've said, there must be specific ones in there, but yeah, he's been such a blanket kind of advocate of Hitchcock's style and theme and feel as well, that it kind of does, can't help but blanket the whole kind of film. But in a way that, whereas maybe I think some of De Palma's films gets hit with that stick a little harder, this one can breathe in its own way and is very much its own thing, whilst having these electric kind of set pieces that feel Hitchcockian in the way it builds tension and suspense. But whilst tying into something that is, you know, explicitly like a New York movie and a gangster movie and this character piece as well. So I think this is, you know, this could well be an example of one that's how to do it, really, where it's like you kind of go, yeah, that does kind of feel Hitchcockian, but like I'm not really going to point out any big things here.
It's not like Phantom of the Paradise, where it's kind of got him aping the shower scene from Psycho or anything like that. So a couple of quiz questions for you guys. How many times is the word fuck said in this film? Who wants to take a guess? Mark, do you want to go first?
I would say it's less than Scarface, so I would say somewhere in the region of about 150, maybe.
Okay, Matt, do you want to take a guess? Higher or lower?
I'd say higher, maybe like a 181 or something.
The correct answer, Mark, was closer. It's 139 in this film. And
that's a lot of fucks to give.
And how many split diopter shots do we get in this film? Again, we'll go to you, Mark. How many do you reckon there are?
This is a trick question, surely. I don't know. I'm going to say, well, maybe 50, maybe more. Let's go with around 50, but I could be missing ones. I don't know.
It is. It's single figures. Matt, do you want to? Sorry. I should have asked Matt first.
I'm going to say it's just the one in the bar scene right before the knifeman gets John Ortiz, when it's like close up on Pacino's face as the guy's running behind him. It's blinking, you miss it almost. But other than that, I didn't quite notice any others.
Well, there's a couple more, and some of them are just like the way in which like the camera is done and the kind of staging of it. So there's seven in total. One of them is when Carlito first talks to Sasso and he's in the mirror. So obviously like the depth of field in that, like obviously he's much further back. There's the one you mentioned in the bar scene. There's a really subtle one as well, when Carlito and Gail are in the DA's office and they're sat on the couch, and it's a split diopter, and it's a split diopter, but it's done at a Dutch angle as well. And it's really weird because, yeah, obviously split diopter sometimes messes with the kind of, I don't know, like the proportions of people in some way. There's an amazing one when Steffi first talks to Carlito in the bar and he's focused on the dancer on the dance floor that looks like Gail.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, yeah, she's in perfect focus, the dance, and it's almost like you're kind of, you're like him, you're looking back and forth between the two of them, going like, what should
literally
I be?
one eye on the other girl.
Yeah. There's a really quick one as well, which is there is a shot of the clock at Grand Central Station. I think it's just as they come down the bottom of the stairs. You can see the clock and then just like everything happening behind it. And it, again, it's really fucking quick. And there is a really quick one on the train as well, when you've got the fat guy kind of standing by like the train door and Carlito's coming towards him.
Mm-hmm.
And then just right at the beginning in that courtroom scene as well, you have Carlito and Kleinfeld in the foreground. And then you have like the prosecution. And that's, yeah, again, done like a split diopter. If they're not, I blame the Twitter account, which lists every split diopter shot in films. And yeah, they've listed seven this movie. Right. Well, yeah, Mark, you've got a head off, right? Should we let you go? And then me and Matt will wrap this bad boy up, or?
If that's all right with you guys.
Yeah, that's of course. Before you go though, Mark, where can people keep up to date with everything you're doing, and where can they buy that bloody Al Pacino book?
So I'm on Twitter, Mark_Searby, my website, marksearby.com. You can buy Al Pacino, The Movies Behind the Man, from all good and some bad ebook retailers. There are some secondhand copies that float about on eBay as well, so you can buy them there. It is 664 pages of Al Pacino's filmography, so it includes deep dives into every single film he's made. It starts with pre-production and the filming and critical reviews, box office returns, and analysis from me. And it also includes over 60 exclusive interviews, all done by myself with people who have worked with Pacino through the years.
Well, thank you so much for movie bratting and broing with me, Mark. And thanks for coming along.
Cheers, Mark.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I've enjoyed it.
So now it's just me and you, Matt. We get to have the fun discussion of how this film compares to Francis Ford Coppola's 1993 output. But before we do that, I want to know, does this film contain any nepotism? Could you see any overt nepotism in this film? Were there people there who shouldn't have been there? I know it's a big talking point at the moment. Nepotism babies.
Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of people in this are legit, and I think a lot of the supporting characters are probably from, you know, like New York actors. I can't see them having like well-known parents. I don't know John Leguizamo's background or where Penelope Ann Miller kind of comes from, or even Pacino, actually, like if he had any famous acting parents. But I think it's got a lot less, for sure, than a standard Coppola joint.
It's really funny you say about John Leguizamo, because it took them ages to get him in this film. Like,
well, I love that he did this and Super Mario Brothers in the same year. I mean, that's range, baby.
the top and the bottom of the barrel all in one foul swoop. Yeah, and that makes it even more bizarre that it took loads of convincing to make him like be in this film, because he was, I think he was like a really big stage actor at the time, and like his concern were that it was a small part. But I guess like everybody kind of knows like Benny from the Bronx.
Yeah, I mean, hey, there's no small parts, only small actors, and this is a perfect proof of that. Like, his screen time may be low, but his impact is high, and you know, he caps off the whole thing.
Yeah, so yeah, fascinating, I guess.
And you're right. I think if you say to most movie fans, "I'm Benny Blanco from the," and stop, people will say Bronx. Like, you know, it's in there. Yeah. It's in the collective.
So the film that we are looking at for this chat is well, the closest film by release date is actually the same film that I looked at last time with Mary Wilde, and it is Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. So which film do you think fared better at the box office?
Oh, probably Dracula. I think it was a big deal, right? The fact that it was Coppola at that point, and, you know, a big Dracula story, having this big kind of gothic, lavish. I mean, was it a blockbuster? Like, I don't remember, but it feels like one that could have been marketed that way. And it feels like it's had more of a cultural impact as well, overall.
Well, let's have a look at the box office for, as I said, the box office for this film was $63 million. Off a budget of $30 million. The budget for Dracula was $10 million more than this, so $40 million. Box office return was $215.9 million. So at the box office, it wiped the floor with Carlito's Way, you could imagine. you could easily say, right?
Yeah. My God, what a time.
But in regards to one of the things I like to look at is like, in regards to kind of cultural impact, what do you think kind of has had, which film has had more of an impact on cinema as a whole, would you say? Like, what would those reasons?
Well, this is it. I'd probably say, you know, Carlito's Way, because whether people, you know it offhand, I think to the general moviegoer, you know, they all know Scarface, they might not know this. I think whether they realize it or not, you know, so many gangster movies have kind of been inspired by this or in some way the feel. And like I said, you know, the Kleinfeld character being lifted wholesale for a number of things. And yeah, I think it's just a really, really amazing sort of mid-career Pacino performance here, seeing as how far he's gone on to. And one that's, yeah, manages to play into type and against type. I think he's wonderful. Like, I think the voiceover that we kind of touched upon as well, like, again, that's something that has the potential to be so kind of hacky and cheesy. And I think it's just so well done, like, through his delivery and kind of the things he highlights that he says in it. So, yeah, I'd like to say that this has the bigger cultural hit. Certainly for me it does, although I know Dracula does have a lot of big fans. But Dracula is something that, you know, is done again and again so often anyway. So there's always new iterations and old iterations to pull from when there's a new vampire story, if not a Dracula one, being done. Whereas this feels a lot more unique.
Definitely. And like you saying, that whole like GTA aspect of Carlito's Way, like, it almost, like, when you get to that bit of them trying to break, like trying to do the job to get the guy out of prison, that feels like a GTA mission, right?
Yeah, it is.
Get to the speedboat, like jump in, drive out there. You got to go to the floating pink marker, make sure your boat's there. Cue cut scene, and then, like, do you know what I mean? You would imagine, like, I don't know,
then it would be like a race around the town to like get away to, from gangsters straight away. So yeah, I think looking at it now,
it's the Ken Rosenberg, the character from GTA Vice City, who is just wholesale Kleinfeld, and then Mike Strutter from Paul K. Like, just look him up. It's the funniest thing ever, and it is exactly down to the color of his shirt.
Yeah, I'm trying to think because I know that there is a character that Danny Dyer voices that turns up in a couple of GTA games. I think he's in Vice City and San Andreas, and I'm not sure if Ken Rosenberg might, or he might die in Vice City, if I remember rightly. He might see the same as Kleinfeld in this.
But what if Danny Dyer is the voice of the Kleinfeld stand-in? My God.
No. He's the voice of Kent Paul, who's like a...
Oh, yes.
If you remember him, he's like this kind of crazy like music promoter that you have to deal with and normally have to go get him drugs from one place and deliver it to Sex Fist or something, the band that he manages. I could talk about GTA all night, but this isn't the GTA podcast. That's my next venture. The thing I want to know is how many Benny Blanco from the Bronx out of five do you give this film, Matt?
Oh, this is the full Benny. This is the full Benny five, baby. Yeah, it's one that I haven't rewatched in quite some time. So I was interested to see if this was one that, you know, had a bit of a place in my head anyway. Because since I've started Letterboxd, of course, I've only logged stuff that I've watched since having an account. So if it's not on there, but I know I've seen it before, then it means I haven't seen it since at least 2014. And it wasn't there. It's been longer than that. And I was like, yeah, this is easily, happily a straight five. It's probably my favorite De Palma. It's one of my favorite Pacinos. It's one of my favorite gangster films. The list goes on. It's incredible.
I think it's their best, like, team. Mm-hmm. I prefer it much more than Scarface. I think it's because it's a lot more soulful and, like, poetic and, like, the way... Yeah, that voiceover, which I know David Koepp had a lot of problems with trying to figure out when that voiceover is supposed to be from. Do you know what I mean? When is Carlito narrating this? Or like, because, and it does at some points get a bit confusing. It's almost like him out of body watching all this stuff again at points, because he kind of says, like,
well, yeah, I like to think it is him. You know, we see him get shot at the start. I like to think the whole film is him remembering everything whilst being on that gurney. And, you know, and the voiceover is that, it's his memory from bleeding out and being, because that's it. The voiceover has a kind of a sense of calmness to him, which doesn't always come across out of the context of scenes. And, you know, some of the stuff he says is kind of things you think about and realize about yourself after something has passed. And in this case, you know, it's pretty much his actual life. You know, all the little bits he has, like when he says about trying to recognize people after you've been away for a while. He's like, everybody's got a different face. Maybe you do too. And, you know, if you can't see the angles anymore, you're fucked. And it's like he's realizing all his mistakes in life now that he's suffered the consequences and is able to kind of impart that sort of wisdom as we see over the events of the film.
Yeah, it's like that moment when when John Ortiz's character, he sees that his dead body and he's like, you poor, beautiful boy. Like, do you know what I mean? It kind of comes first person like that. Like, because I was like, is he saying, because you don't see his face. It's like, is this a voiceover or is this him saying this? And it's the voiceover, because as you said, it's got this real like calmness. Like the way he delivers that closing monologue is just great, when he's like, I knew at one point I was going to be like, I'd be taking a visit to the mortuary. Everybody thought it was going to be a lot earlier than this. He's like, last of the Mohicans, maybe not the last. And it's just like, it's kind of, I don't know, kind of like a guy rambling at the bar. Do you know what I mean? It's a fascinating way to encapsulate the kind of the calmness of death as well.
And it's such an antithesis to the kind of, you know, the big hoo-ah Pacino, which, you know, is... You can feel it under the surface, but he's reining it in here. And I think anyone who thinks of Pacino as a bit of a one-note actor, I mean, first of all, you're insane. You know, he's clearly one of the greats. But this just shows how different he can be from the, say hello to my little friend, to this, you know, that, you know, you could think he's doing another gangster film with the same director, but you know, this is a million miles away from Tony Montana, and he's impeccable.
And that feels like a good place to leave this chat. Is there is there any other any other you mentioned that there's De Palma films you hadn't seen. Is there what would be the one film that you're most excited to check out? Let's leave the conversation on that.
Yeah, no, I really want to see Dressed to Kill. I think that's probably the biggest profile one of his I haven't seen. Like I've done Scarface, Carrie, Mission Impossible, Untouchables, Blowout, this, Phantom of the Paradise, Body Double, even Sisters, actually, one of his really early ones. Is it Sisters?
Yeah, Sisters is kind of like the first of the like De Palma films. You know, when he started being, because before that it's kind of New York comedies with Robert De Niro. It's kind of this weird like delineation in his career. It's like three movies, they're kind of black and white, they're Robert De Niro, then after that it's kind of, now I'm getting a bit Hitchcockian and a bit thrillery.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so Dressed to Kill I think is up there for some real 80s femme fatale noirness that isn't femme fatale 2002's femme fatale.
Perfect. Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming and talking some De Palma with me.
Thank you, man.
Well, there we have it, guys. That was fun, wasn't it? A massive thank you to Matt and Mark for joining me. And as always, a massive thank you to you guys, the Patreons, because as you know already, you're the real ones. You're the real ones. Obviously, as I said on the last episode, if you're enjoying this Patreon stuff, please share it on socials. Like when I put out the link on all the socials for the episodes and stuff like that, give them a share. Like let other people know that there's some good stuff going on behind this, let's be honest, very small paywall that I've probably undercutted myself by putting and over extending myself and being like, yeah, it'll be fortnightly and it'll be £2.50 a month. So but at the same time, it's still a lot of fun. As for next time on Movie Brat Bros, we're keeping it in the kind of gangster vein, but we're heading back to 1987, and we're actually heading back to the 1930s, because I will be joined by Rich Nelson of the Do You Want Me podcast, and formerly of the Betamax Video Club, to discuss The Untouchables. If you've seen that film, in the comments to this one, let me know what you think of that film. I really want to know. I really want a bit more of like a kind of community vibe up in this house. Let me know as well. I'll put a post out separately just in case people don't listen to this. But you guys who are listening to this, would you like me to share the show notes I make for, well, not the show notes, but the kind of notes I make for all the episodes, stuff like that, kind of, and share the share the Google Doc, like a spreadsheet that shows which guests are coming up and stuff like that. Not just for this, but on the main channel as well. Yeah, let me know if you want any of that. And just give you an extra peek behind the curtain. Again, a massive thank you to all you guys for being supporters of this little venture that we're doing over here. So as always, I've been Petros Patsilivus. I've been Movie Brattin, and I've been Broin, and I'll catch you next time on De Palmarama.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.